And then, you know, I don't have one of those like clappers, you know, or right. like start. So that's what I have to do. But oh, you know what? I was watching Ken Burns.
Yeah.
He did the same thing. That's he right. literally went like this. And I was like, holy cow, Ken Burns is just like me.
That's right. That's great.
So welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. As we've mentioned before, publication of the Book of Mormon predates the modern Pentecostal movement by almost 8 decades. So how did speaking in tongues get in the Book of Mormon? What are some examples? Dr. Christopher Thomas teaches at the Pentecostal Theological Seminary, and he's going to share his thoughts about speaking in tongues in the Book of Mormon. You won't want to miss this conversation. Check it out.
And then the next big section of the book, I wanted to put the Book of Mormon into conversation with Pentecostalism.
Right. Yeah, that's where I wanted to go next. That's awesome.
And I started with these kind of proto-Pentecostals with whom there seems to have been some connection with the Restoration. There was this Irvingite pastor who met with Smith, Joseph Smith in Kirtland, I think it was 1835, and proposed an amalgamation because the Catholic Apostolic Church was believed in the restoration of apostles, prophets, etc., and in the gifts of the Spirit. And so it's documented that there was this meeting. Smith or one of his assistants apparently respond to this, but several years later. And Bruce Van Orden argues that this piece, I think it may have been in the Times and Seasons, was not written by Smith, but by one of his subordinates.
W.W. Phelps, probably.
Yes, thanks for that. In part because apparently Joseph is giving women, acknowledging certain status issues for women, but part of the reason the Irvingites get rejected in this article is because of the role women played at the beginning of the movement. And so that's been kind of an interesting tension that people have picked up on. So I wanted to look at that. I wanted to look at this guy named John Alexander Dowie. Dowie was, I think he may have been Scottish, wound up in Australia. A daughter nearly dies. He becomes a healing evangelist, comes to the United States, passes through Salt Lake. It's in all the newspapers, Dowie's story, and wants to be an apostle in the
LDS Church.
In the LDS Church. And when they explain that's not quite how it works, Dowie castigates them all, moves to Chicago, establishes Zion, Illinois.
Oh.
And then begins this, and it's in, and you can kind of track it in the newspapers, says that he sends word to Salt Lake that he's bringing 3,000, I think it was, evangelists, and he's going to convert the lot of the Mormons.
John Hamer spoke about this at John Whitmer
did he?
A couple of years ago, yes.
And, you know, the brethren said, well, come on, you know. Well, what people didn't know was that Dowie was going to reveal that polygamy was to be lived out in Mexico. And this was right in the middle of the mopping up period. This was 1890s.
Oh, right.
Right. And then there's this.
Mormons were kind of doing that anyway.
Well, that is right. And then there was this guy who some look upon as the founder of Pentecostalism, who believed in British Israelism,
mm-hmm.
very similar to, his name was Parham, very similar to, my man who did the concordance on the Book of Mormon, Reynolds, George Reynolds.
Oh, Oh, George Reynolds was also the guy who the Supreme Court case was about.
That's right. That's right. And Reynolds was very similar in the British Israelism. Now, I was never able to quite connect Parham. I'd heard a rumor that he had been laughed off a stage in the independence group, but I could never track that down. But I mm-hmm. tried to ease into things that way. And then I looked at early Pentecostal responses to the Book of Mormon and Mormonism in the early Pentecostal periodical literature. And the very first one was kind of amazingly generous, because somebody had written into the paper and said, "Why don't you talk about the Mormons speaking in tongues?" And the editor kind of, you know, castigates the Mormons, you know, they're not trustworthy, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, "But when I lived in the Rocky Mountains in the 1870s, I came across this older woman who seemed to be a real saint of God, who told me that the Mormons were like the old Methodists, the old time Methodists." And he said, "It reminded me of the text that said, 'God may have a people even among these people.'" Well, I didn't expect that.
Wow.
You know, because it's usually knives and daggers, right? And so I tried to, nobody had ever done that. And then the next part of that section was to take the Pentecostal kind of heart of our theology, that Jesus is Savior, Sanctifier, Spirit Baptizer, Healer, and soon coming King, and talk about the ways that those themes do and don't show up in the Book of Mormon. So that was my attempt to kind of engage. And then the last part of the book, which I wasn't really all that interested in writing, was on origins, because when I started rummaging around in Book of Mormon studies, 95% of what was written was, "It is historical, it's not historical," mm-hmm. "is to, is mm-hmm. not." And, you know, that we didn't need another voice on all that. So what I tried to do was to cite Joseph Smith's 1832 statement about the coming forth of the book. And then I did a section I entitled "Complications to the Standard Story," which looks at all the, you know, problematic areas, DNA, archaeology, anachronisms, etc. And then I did a section that I entitled "A Taxonomy of Readers," which briefly surveyed how readers have responded to the complications, from "No matter what the complications are, it's all going to be vindicated," to all the way over to Dan of Ogle, "It's all Joseph," and kind of everything in between. You know, there's a couple of Community of Christ scholars that have written, "It's not historical, but it's a prophetic parable," right? Then you have people like Joe Spencer at BYU who says, "The focus really is on the reading of the book." Now, I know Joe, you know, is a believer in the kind of historical viability. But I tried to survey the different ways people read. All of them had to be, at least at one point in their life, folk for whom the book functioned as scripture. And so the people that were reading the manuscript, and I broached the subject of whether I needed anything or not, they were all like, no, you got to say something about this. So the only way I knew to really talk about it was like I might talk about the pastoral epistles, which the authorship is really challenged, and kind of start with what does the text claim, and then what are the complications, and then how have people responded.
Like did Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yeah, but in the case of the 1st, 2nd Timothy, and Titus, that's really, but it's like that.
Yeah.
But it's that's the real contested section
whether
of
Paul
of Paul's.
Wrote those.
Yeah, right. So I just tried to continue to be faithful to how I was reading the Book of Mormon, in keeping with how I've tried to read the New Testament.
So do you have an opinion on authorship that you'd like to share?
Probably not. I would say I am still not numbered amongst those who consider the book scripture. What was really interesting...
And I know my listeners are going to say, now why not?
Well, there are different ways of reading. I've been asked that question before. I think what's hard for people who don't know the culture to understand is just how important a testimony is in this whole thing. A testimony that the Book of Mormon is true. Which to me is quite interesting because and I say a little bit about this in the book, you have something that is exterior to the text being called upon to validate the text, right? Now, I know you've got the famous Moroni text about praying to see if it is not true.
Right.
Right. But I don't think people outside the tradition, well, I didn't till I took a deeper dive, understand just the kind of power that has with folk. The whole notion of the testimony that the Book of Mormon is true, Joseph's prophet is the true church. As I said earlier, the experience I've had with folk is it all kind of gets reverse engineered. I've got problems with Abraham. I got problems with polygamy. So, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, would you? I'm going to ask it this way.
Sure.
Would you be closer to the Dan Vogel interpretation or the traditional interpretation for authorship?
Well, you're not giving up here, are you? It reminds me of my granddaughter when my wife's cat died, and she said, "Daber, are you sad that the cat died?" And I said, "I'm sad for your Nana." And she said, "Yeah, but are you sad up there?" Well, I think there are a lot of complications. I don't spend a lot of time rummaging around in that, in part because I don't know that there's anything to be gained by it. Okay. And so... I think it's ambitious. I think it's an ambitious claim, right? What I've hoped the book could do is to show how many things there are for us all to talk about, mm-hmm. about the Book of Mormon, regardless of what you make of origins.
Right.
Right. I mean, Grant Hardy, I think one of the great strengths of Grant's book was saying, can we at least read the book and talk about what we're reading? And that's what, that's what I've been, my intention has been.
Yeah.
I know people, people want everybody to pick sides, right? And I think that there is plenty of evidence out there for people to make informed decisions.
Right.
On those sorts of things.
Right. So. And I know it would be funny. I think most Mormons would find it strange if anybody even came and said, I like your church. I don't believe Joseph Smith is a prophet. I don't really believe in the Book of Mormon, but I just like hanging out. I mean, we'd probably put up with them for a while, but we wouldn't be like, yeah, we're going to get you in the font until you start to admit these things. I mean, is that something in evangelicalism or Protestantism or, Church of God, I think is where you go. Is that something that you would be okay with? Would you baptize someone who didn't confess Jesus or anything like that?
Probably not.
Okay.
I was going to say, I guess it depends on whether they're tithers or not.
What if they were willing to pay tithing?
That's what somebody said one day. And I said, well, it depends on tithing or not, doesn't it? And then my LDS friend said, well, there's a lot of truth there. But I think that, in the history of Pentecostalism, you've had lots of people kind of loosely affiliated with the church that haven't taken kind of steps for membership. Usually we interpret that as the Lord's dealing with them and is drawing them, wooing them in, but they need to respond at some point. I think most LDS folk, you know, when I was sorting through what to do on the origins business, I'd just done a seminar for the Church History Library, and they'd taken me to lunch in that lovely restaurant that overlooks Temple Square, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling this guy,
it's up in the Joseph Smith Building.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And I was telling this guy next to me, you know, of my dilemma and not knowing what to do, and then telling him what I thought I would do, which wound up being it. And he said, hey, he said, you're an outsider that's sympathetic. It don't matter what you say. They're going to be so happy to have somebody that's doing what you're doing, yeah, that you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Now, you know, I think here, I mean, I haven't talked about this any, but I think here it's kind of a perfect storm, kind of a convergence of my methodological approach. Because if I were a historical critical interpreter, the place historical critical interpreters start is with the life setting, with the Zitzim Leben, with the context.
Mm-hmm.
If you're historical critical, you're going to start with 1830.
Right.
You're going to figure out who wrote this, how was it written, before you ever get to what's in it. But because that's not how I approach, I was trained in historical critical studies, but they seemed pretty bankrupt to me in biblical studies after a while. And I moved toward a more narrative literary approach in the first instance. So that, in a lot of ways, frees me up to be able to read the book in what people might or might not consider profitable ways, right? Because I'm reading with the grain. I'm not reading to say, ah, well, there.
That's where it's messed up.
This is plagiarized, yeah, or right, there, well, that's just wrong, or, you know, but trying to, again, that whole suspending disbelief, right? Well, what's the text saying? And starting there then, I mean, I think that that's in keeping with how I try to read New Testament texts. And there's a lot we don't know historically about New Testament texts. Mm-hmm. One of my good friends said, it's amazing sometimes in our introductory courses that we spend most of our time on the things we're the least certain about. You know, who wrote what, where was it written, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, those are important, but in this case, but I think this is kind of like I do my biblical studies. To me, it's not determinative whether Joseph wrote it, whether, you know, however it came about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Christopher Thomas. Our next conversation with Chris is going to be our last, so if you haven't signed up to our free newsletter at gospeltangents.com/newsletter, you'll miss our final part of the conversation. So remember to sign up so I can send you that secret link. In our next conversation, we're going to talk about the fact that Pentecostals actually have a more strict dress code than even Mormons.
Well, the version of Pentecostalism I grew up in is kind of the holiness tradition. And there were real clear kind of dress mores, right? I mean, the women seemed to bear a disproportionate amount of the weight of those. In my tradition, women were really looked down on if they didn't wear dresses or something something similar to a dress. They couldn't wear pants, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Sure couldn't do that in church, but just in normal attire. And I remember as a boy hearing discussions of women who worked in factories saying, well, I know we're not supposed to, but it's, you know, it is not decent for me to not wear pants, being up on the the next floor. The people could see up their dresses, etc.
If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please subscribe for just $5 a month at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and you can hear the entire interview before everybody else. If you'd like to watch the entire video for just $8 a month, you can either subscribe on YouTube, Patreon, or my website, gospeltangents.com. Just click the yellow subscribe button, and I'll add you to our Gospel Tangents Insiders group so that you can see entire videos. For those interested in a PDF transcript, you can subscribe at either Patreon or on my website. For just $10 a month, I'll send you a PDF as soon as it's complete. If you'd like a copy of the paperback as well as a PDF, just sign up for $20 a month at either Patreon or my website, gospeltangents.com. Of course, you can buy individual transcripts at amazon.com and just do a search for Gospel Tangents Interview, and you can see all the things that we have there. Don't forget to support Gospel Tangents with an awesome t-shirt like one of these. You can subscribe at Apple Podcasts at tinyurl.com/gospeltangents. Get our latest updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Also, you can get our Twitter updates at gospeltangents. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got more of our great videos. Thanks again.